Welcome to Fight Back Radio, the Marxist voice of labor and youth in Canada, and the best source for revolutionary analysis of current events, perspectives, and theory.
When you look into how Marx analyzed the economy, it can initially seem surprising that he began with the commodity. You would think he'd maybe begin with more exciting topics like capital, labor, the things that matter. But you know, if you look at the economy today and you read the analysis of the bourgeois, especially in regards to why we have a crisis, they'll list out a multitude of factors. There's so many moving parts. And actually that chaos is a good cover for them, right? They can explain away the crisis through all sorts of various things. And so what Marx tried to do was get to the bottom of the matter, to show the inner workings of capitalism. And it's on that basis that he began with the commodity. Marx described capitalism as wealth appears as a mass of commodities. Generalized commodity production and exchange is very unique to capitalism. And I think to understand the whole system as it works, we really need to understand this very basic unit of capitalism, which is the commodity. So what do I mean when I say commodity? What are we talking about? I randomly searched, I think in the Financial Post, like commodity, and most of the stuff that showed up was basically raw materials. It was like dairy, minerals, oil, this sort of stuff came up. But if you look at the Marxist understanding of what a commodity is, it's much broader than that. Really, it's any sort of good or service that is the product of labor that is produced not for the sake of meeting the needs of the producer themselves, but for social need. And really, like, in a sense, this contradicts all previous forms of production in previous pre-class societies, where primarily production was for direct consumption of the consumer themselves. So you can take the example, for instance, under feudalism, where the peasant worked the land and the crops that were sowed would be consumed by the family of the peasant. And even the amount that would go to the lord in the tribute to tax, that would also just get directly consumed by the lord. It wasn't accumulated in any sort of sense. So when Marx talked about the commodity, he explained that there is a dual nature within it. On the one side, he explained that commodities have to have a use value. They have to have a utility. And that derives from the concrete qualities of any given good or service, meaning that it ultimately has to fulfill some sort of need, be it physical or mental. And so this can be anything from like food to cinema. All of this would count. And actually, commodities can fulfill use values that evolve. New needs can be met, and so goods and services can meet those new needs, like razors or, yeah, movies, iPhones. These are all new sort of needs that have emerged as society has developed. But a commodity, like I said, is not for the direct consumption to meet the needs of the producer themselves. It's actually meant to meet the needs of others. And so this really raises the question of how are commodities exchanged? How do others access those goods? And Marx pointed out that the only way is that a commodity has to have, on top of a use value, an exchange value, which raises an important question, is how do we compare different commodities? What is that exchange value objectively based upon? And this is actually a question that is quite confusing. There's a lot of debate happening even right now about what the value of a commodity is based upon. So marginal utility theory would answer the question that I just asked by essentially saying that the value is based on its usefulness, based on the use value. So let's apply maybe that just for a second, if we base it upon its use value. So if I go to the grocery store and there's, you know, a pile of oranges and there's a pile of avocados. Now, pretty much every single time I've ever grocery shopped, the one orange is always going to be cheaper than any given avocado. Like an orange is a couple of cents. An avocado is at least like $1.30. It always costs more. So why? I mean, if you base it on utility, actually, funny enough, this is both food that I'm talking about, right? Avocado, oranges. They're both fulfilling the same usefulness in that sense. But why does the avocado cost more? And maybe the marginal utility theorist will tell me, well, the avocado is just yummier. It's better. It has intrinsically, it's more valuable in that sense. Now, to be honest, like, that is incredibly subjective. I personally would pick the orange over the avocado any day. Like, avocados are very risky. I mean, they're sometimes super underripe, super overripe. An orange is a better deal, I think. But maybe I'll take a different example. Compare maybe a can of chickpeas to a laptop. Now, we all know there's no way you put the can of chickpeas beside the laptop and you've somehow found equivalent value. You know, it's going to take a ton, hundreds and hundreds of cans of chickpeas piled up beside a laptop until you eventually get to the point that you can be like, okay, maybe you found equal value in these two things sitting side by side. And I have to ask, like, where did that ratio come from? Why would it be like 300 cans of chickpeas to a laptop? Is that just arbitrary? So this investigation of value actually was begun by the bourgeois economists themselves, which is kind of ironic, because if you look at what the bourgeois economists say today, like, marginal utility theory is very subjective, idealist, confusing, but the objective basis for value, yeah, was first investigated by the likes of Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and they really laid the foundation upon which Marx was able to further develop the labor theory of value. The most advanced analysis from the bourgeois, you could say, came from David Ricardo, who essentially said that it was the labor contained within the product, within the commodity, that determined its value, which sounds great, sounds right. But Marx raised some interesting questions around this. He clarified, because he asked, all sorts of labor go into any commodity. Unique skills go into the labor to produce any commodity. So for instance, you have baking, unique skills there. Sewing has its own set of skills. Carpentry has its own set of skills. How do you objectively compare the value of the labor of a baker to the labor of a carpenter? Again, actually, you could bring in a subjective basis here. If you're super hungry, the labor of the baker maybe would be way more valuable to you than the labor of a carpenter. But this is where Marx dove deeper underneath the surface, underneath the appearance of things, and said, just like I was trying to explain how we have to analyze the value of a commodity, we actually have to put aside its unique usefulness to get to the bottom of things. We also, at the same time, actually have to put aside the unique type of labor that has gone into that commodity. We have to put aside all of those unique skills and particular features of the labor that have gone in to determine what the common denominator across all commodities is, which Marx pointed out is simply labor time. But this, again, doesn't end the matter. Marx went further, and he asked, actually, well, is it just labor time for individual producers? Because labor time varies, even for one and the same commodity. And different producers actually, like, yeah, can produce the same thing at different times. So I'll give an example. You know, let's say me and Michael are bakers, right? And Michael has way more skills than I do. He's making scones, and he can make them in like 15 minutes, right? He's super efficient. He knows how to do it. He does that. I'm making the scones. I'm terrible at baking. I take an hour. I take an hour to make a decent edible scone that Michael is going to produce in a fraction of that time, right? There is this variation, obviously, between human beings and how long they're going to take. But even more than that, to be honest, even Michael, let's say he starts out the day being super productive and 15 minutes to a scone, but by the end of the day, he's producing the Renu level, right? He's producing at like an hour. He's tired. It's been a busy day. Now, this obviously, people laugh, like, it sounds ridiculous, because in our experience in the real economy, this is not what we see. You go into a grocery store, you go into the bakery section, and you see a row of scones. It's not going to be like, the first is the Michael scone, and it's like $2. And at the back of the row is the Renu scone, which is like $10 or something, because it's just way more labor went into it. That's obviously not what we see. In general, what we meet is like a standard value for any standard good. And this is the result of what Marx explained of the development of socially necessary labor time, that the value of any commodity is not based upon the labor of any one individual to produce any given good, but the overall productivity of society to provide for that good, the labor time that society requires. And this may seem simple. I'm going to get into it because it's actually quite an interesting, contradictory phenomenon. It's a historically evolved phenomenon. I mentioned this before, that pre-capitalist societies also had exchange. On the fringes of communities where tribes would meet, they would be able to exchange the surplus, right? And that sort of exchange in the early days is like barter economy. And the exchange values that are happening, the exchange of goods, is in many ways like accidental. You know, maybe you meet and you exchange the clay pot for a nice woven basket, but then the next time that community meets, maybe that clay pot is instead being traded like for a cow or something. You know, there's no like standardized ratio or values that really meet. And that really isn't possible until the rise of capitalism. It's production and exchange under mass production and exchange under capitalism that allows the development of some sort of standardization to a level that, we've never seen before. Because with the rise of capitalism, what you have is a massive market. And actually, the only way to access any goods in society is to exchange them, right? That means you have massive, massive amounts of exchange. And these acts allow for the comparison of commodities that over time allows for a standardized expectation of how much amount of labor is meant to go into any particular good or another. But it's not just on the side of this increased amount of exchange that you have socially necessary labor time emerge. It's also something that develops on the productive side with the rise essentially of collectivized production. So you have, under capitalism, masses of workers put side by side to produce any given commodity. And at the same time, the task that any given worker is doing becomes more and more simplified, especially with the rise of technology. So I'll take the baker example again. Like I said, originally, a baker would be extremely skilled. They're overlooking the entire process of the creation of their good. You know, they are this, very, very skilled worker, in a sense. But today, how is food produced? It's like massive production with mass machinery. And I'll give a personal example. My family in BC owned like a raspberry farm. And sometimes over the summertime, I would help out, make some extra pocket change pretty much. And so what did that process look like? You would have this enormous machine that you would climb into, you sit on the top, and this massive machine, within like a minute, could move to the end of one entire row of crops. And it would automatically like pluck basically everything. And what did the workers do? There was me, there was all these other workers. I was like 8 years old or something. I was just there for fun. And we would just pull out the crap. Like all of these raspberries would come out of this belt, and there would be like little bits of leaves, sometimes like wasps and shit. And the workers, just like the menial task is them just removing the little bits. Meanwhile, the most of the product is coming through this machine. In that sense, the task of any given worker is very much reduced to the exact same thing. The machine forces this like regularization of the standard labor time, because actually, I witnessed it, the belt of food wouldn't stop, right? It's just coming and coming. You have to keep up with the pace of it. You have to move faster if the food coming on this belt is coming faster. So from the particular skilled labor of a baker, an artisan, a carpenter, mass exchange and production under capitalism creates a general unit of human labor, abstracted away from all of its uniqueness, its unique use values, the unique types of labor, into what Marx termed abstract human labor. And the way that this standard of socially necessary labor time is upheld is ultimately through competition. It's not like a decision that was made from like above by the capitalist and imposed. It organically developed and it organically expresses itself. So imagine, again, you go to a grocery store and you have two bags of like oranges in front of you. Now the one bag is made using the technology, the technique, the machinery of the day to produce, right? To pluck the oranges, whatever, kind of like the process I described. The other one was handpicked. Between these two, one, the handpicked one, has a lot more labor time, obviously, that goes into it to get a single bag of like oranges. Which one are you gonna buy? Like one bag of oranges probably, you know, like you go to a farmer's market, you see this, is gonna cost like double the price. And I bet you anything, most people are gonna buy the cheap one. And actually this is how the products that don't meet up to the standard of socially necessary labor time, that meet up to the level of productivity and technique that society has developed to, are going to be eliminated from the market. Now, this is, I think, like makes, I'm gonna kind of make a philosophical kind of point here, because the fact that Marx was able to analyze this and express this historically evolved phenomenon, you compare it to what the bourgeois provide in how they think exchange values developed. And this is like the Robinson Crusoe example that often still gets like used in economic classes, of like this one dude, this castaway on an island by himself, just knows the amount of labor efficiently that's meant to go randomly into every little thing. And he has it all parceled out and he plans out his day to know not a minute more should go into the production of any one thing. I mean, this is the very like individualist, isolated view that the bourgeois take to the economy. It's just individuals. Like today, capitalism is just an multiplication of like the barter economy or something. Whereas like this actually is a very surface level understanding. The real process taking place underneath the surface of massive social relations being developed is what Marx analyzed and explained. And this sort of development is very confusing, because like when we, and it's understandable, because when we go into the economy and you buy goods, you know, you don't see the social relations. Like what you see are things, right? You see are the commodities. And the values that you meet at the market, like I said, are standardized. So standardized that it almost seems as if like the value is some sort of physical feature of the commodity itself. And so what ends up, what society ends up looking like is a movement of just these commodities that are dominating us, right? But underneath, it looked like private transaction between things. But what Marx really showed is like these are social relations, social transactions, and movement of people at the end of the day. But capitalism very much like inverts that real relationship between human beings into relationships between things. And I like this one example that Marx actually, I think he gave in Capital to describe how confusing exchange value can be. He compared it to sight. So he said that, you know, if you have light hit your eyes, you're not going to think it's the subjective experience of like my eyeball. It's just having an experience on its own somehow. I would hope that's not what you would think. No, like you would probably, with your eyes being open, look and say there's a light bulb, the physical source of the light from which the light is, you know, emanating and coming into your eye. Ultimately, there is a physical, tangible relationship that you can link up between the light source and you. You can trace the step, right? You cannot do that with exchange value. It's not a physical property of any given commodity in the sense that you can't cut an apple and be like, there's the exchange value. And you can't also see it on the basis of a single commodity alone. Exchange value, like I said, is an evolved phenomenon. It's based upon, you know, it's a product of millions of acts of exchange and production over time that lay the basis for socially necessary labor time for any given commodity. It is dialectical. It's the whole being greater than the sum of its parts. So in talking about value, Marx made an important clarification. I'm just going to speak briefly on this. Between value and price, which has caused a lot of confusion. Okay, cool. Essentially, he explained that there's no like direct relation. There's ultimately an indirect relationship between value and price. Because like we see that the price of goods, you know, one day I go to the store and like I said, typically speaking, oranges cost what? One orange, a couple cents. That can definitely vary, right? And so that ebb and flow is ultimately based on the pressures of supply and demand that can change over time. And Marx never denied that role of supply and demand. But the point is that what Marx raised is like, is your orange ever going to cost the price of a car? It's not going to, right? I think we can all understand that. There is a range in which these prices fluctuate, a kind of a general line upon which they go up and down. And Marx raised like, what is that line? What is that fluctuation? What is that range ultimately based on? And over time, if you look at it, it is the socially necessary labor time that's gone into it that provides kind of the foundation for the value of any good. So far, kind of I described how commodities are ultimately based on their real cost of production, which is the socially necessary labor time. But this raised some very interesting problems and questions around what is capital and what is the role of the capitalist in society? Because the capitalist also buys commodities, like anybody else, for production. They buy raw materials, they buy machinery, they buy something from the worker. And at the end of production, though, they end up with more money than they began with. They get profits. What is happening in that process? Because actually, that seems to violate the labor theory of value. Seems like some value is being created kind of out of nowhere. Because if you think about it, I'll give maybe another example. Let's say I have a toonie. I want to buy coffee. And I go up to like Balzac's or, I don't know if everyone knows, I know some TMU commerce will know, like a fancy coffee shop. If I think I'm gonna walk in with a toonie and walk out with like a fancy lavender latte or something, I would be totally delusional. There's no way. Me and the barista know I'm gonna get what I can pay for. I have $2. And like you can't get that cute little cup of lavender latte that has the little image and the foam and stuff, you know, that's valuable, more valuable than my toonie's gonna get me. So what's probably gonna happen is I have to go down the street to the Tim's to get a plain small cup of coffee. But my point is that we expect an exchange of equivalent values, right? I have $2, I go to the market, I'm gonna get $2 worth of goods back. That is a basic expectation and that falls in line with the labor theory of value. Of equivalent exchange. So that though, again, the capitalists seem to be violating that. They're going into the market with a set amount and then they are walking out like they just got the lavender latte, right? They walk out with more. What happened there? And so one explanation that is given, I think we still hear this today, is essentially that the capitalist is just super clever, super charming. They go into the market and they just con their way into getting all these commodities that they need for production, very, very low level prices, very, very cheaply. They just are super clever and able to do that every single time, apparently. And then when they themselves put those commodities into production and come up with the final good, they mark up the price of that good. And then they just con everyone to buy those goods. And again, I think that this actually also exposes the philosophy of the bourgeois in analyzing the economy that see it from isolated individuals, right? For them, they only see the economy in this one-sided way. This explanation could work if the world was essentially, on the one side, pure sellers, just a group of sellers, and on the other side, just a set of pure buyers. But that is not what the situation really is. Everyone is a buyer and a seller. We all use the market along as well as the capitalists, right? So let's say the capitalists did actually just overinflate the price of a commodity to make a profit, like a surcharge, a tax, whatever, they just slap it on at the end of the day to make that profit. If they did that, they would all do that, obviously, because that's how profits are supposedly being made. And what you would end up with is inflation. You would end up with all commodities being more expensive over time. And if I gained a bunch from selling to Michael at this overinflated price, when I need his good and I go to the market to buy it, I'm gonna lose whatever gain I made by having to buy. Like at the end of the day, there's no new value created. It would just balance out in this process. So Marx was the one who solved the riddle of what capital is. And this is the most revolutionary aspect of Marxist economics. What he explained is that the capitalist, when he goes to the market, they are paying for the value of the commodities that they initially buy for production, all the machinery, raw materials, something from the worker, right? They are paying for the real value. And when he sells those commodities in the market that come out of that productive process, they're also still being sold at their real value, at the amount of socially necessary labor time that has gone into them. There's no manipulation needed. There's no tricks. There's nothing of that sort. What Marx asked was, what is the capitalist purchasing initially? In that initial purchase for the productive process to start, what exactly is being purchased? Like I kind of alluded to it, obviously, by saying like what he's buying something from the worker. But what Marx really pointed out was that the capitalists, what the laborer is selling and what the capitalist is purchasing is not labor. They're not paying for a set amount of concrete goods, of concrete product of labor. That's not what they're paying for. What they're paying for is labor power, is simply the ability of the worker to produce that concrete, those concrete goods and services. Like I mentioned before, that labor power, actually, I don't know if I mentioned this before. Labor power, in that sense, is being sold like any other commodity. And like any other commodity, it has a dual nature. It has a use value and it has an exchange value. So what the capitalist is paying for, in paying for labor power, they're paying for the exchange value. Now, what is exchange value? I've kind of said this many times, but exchange value, again, is the cost of production, ultimately. So what is the cost of production of labor power? It ultimately is the cost of maintenance and reproduction of the laborer themselves. It is ultimately the means of production, the education, the quality of life, and the reproduction for the worker, for the working class to reproduce as the working class, to come back to work and continue the process of production. This is what wages ultimately reflect. This is what the capitalists are paying for. On the other side, though, of labor power, like I said, it has a dual nature, is the use value. So what is the use value of labor power? This is the ability of the worker to create, the ability to work cooperatively, to transform raw materials and machinery, to make commodities, to labor and create value, to create new value than what originally was there. So during the working day, the worker, in that process of working, will cover their own productive costs, will cover effectively their wages. This is the part of the day that Marx called necessary labor, right? It covers the maintenance of the worker themselves. But do they stop there? No. Like the capitalist hasn't bought a set amount of labor from them. It's not as if they said, this is how many, you know, means of subsistence and whatever is going to cost to maintain you, end your day there. No. They bought the life of the worker for a period of time. And the worker has to keep working for that entire period of time, no matter how much is already produced, maybe in the first hour, 2 hours, half of the day. So the worker keeps working. And what is produced overall is surplus labor. It is above and beyond what is necessary for the worker's survival, for the wages. And that product that is created overall in that period of time, it's not the property of the worker, because they were never paid for that. They were just paid to be there and make it. But the ultimate concrete labor that results from this process, that is the property of the capitalist. And that is what they then can realize in profits when they sell it in the market through the act of exchange. When those commodities are ultimately sold, that is when their value is realized and that can be pocketed. Now, maybe this is a bit abstract, and I'll use an example. What time am I at, by the way?
30 minutes.
Oh, wow, okay. I'm doing good. Yeah, so I was at Tim Hortons the other day, and there was like maybe five, you know, minimum wage workers behind the counter. They all get paid around like, what, $15, I suppose, something like that, right? And I was there, there was about 20 of us in the lineup. Actually, it wasn't even that busy. Like, I think I've been in a, you know, a Tim's in the early in the morning, and it's like way, way, way longer, right? But yeah, there was about 20 people there. I myself got like $10 worth of stuff. I got food and I got coffee. Now, let's say in like 30 minutes, they served all of these people in the line, and they all got about the same amount of goods as I got, $10 worth, right? That would be like $200 worth of goods and services that are provided. What is the wage of the workers even in an hour? Is like a fraction of it. They're getting paid minimum wage. In that first hour, the accumulated minimum wage that all these workers combined would make would be like not even $100, not even half, not even half the amount that's been given out in the services and goods to all these people in the lineup. And as you can see this with like customer service workers, because you're always paid the same amount when you go in. But if you're doing, let's say you're, working in a restaurant, you know, during the weekend, you know, you're working overtime. You're going to be serving tons and tons of people, making tons and tons of food orders, all of this, right? You get paid the same amount. And then maybe during the week, though, the restaurant's not as busy, you're still getting paid the same amount. What's changed? The concrete goods and services that you've provided clearly are probably way higher on a Saturday night than they would be like on a Tuesday night. But that really actually speaks to what the worker is getting paid for. They're not getting paid for that concrete goods and services that they've given out. What they're getting paid for is simply their ability to be there and work. And just to make a point, like there's no sharp line between when the worker starts working for themselves and then starts, you know, the surplus labor day or something. It's a continuation of the same process. And actually, like, that really hides what's happening in many ways. Because if you compare to, in some ways, like, compared to previous class societies, it was clearer, the exploitation. Because if you take the example of the serf, you know, they work, let's say, 2 weeks of the month, crop the land, and they consume it for themselves. The other half of the month, the crops go to the Lord, right? If the taxes go up, they're getting exploited more. The peasant definitely knows, because now they're working for themselves maybe 1 week. And then the rest of the month, they're working. It's all going to the Lord. It's very obvious delineation in time and space, what they're getting versus what the Lord is getting. But we don't have that, right? It is very much hidden. But it's exactly why it's hidden that Marx had to really dive underneath the surface to show this historical phenomenon, to give a scientific understanding of what exploitation is based upon, that the surplus that's being generated, the profit that's being made, is ultimately the unpaid labor of the working class. So maybe some would say, well, Renu, you forgot about machinery. That's important. Especially today, it's understandable because, like I said, all the production, especially the most important industries of production, are very, very mechanized. So what is the role that machinery is playing here? It can appear as if they too create value, but what Marx characterized like this machinery as was dead labor. You know, in the productive process, essentially you can divide it up between dead labor and living labor. And what he meant was obviously you have the living labor power that's been bought to work. But then on the other side, you have all these goods, these tools, this machinery, technology that's available, the labor of the workers of the past, the dead labor. And so in this process of production, the worker transforms all of that dead labor to create new commodities. And so what we actually see is not new value being generated by all that dead labor. They undergo a qualitative transformation of form. Like, I'll give maybe two examples. Like, if you have 10 pieces of plywood, you have 10 pieces of plywood. You're not going to be able to change that. But you can take the 10 pieces of plywood and make a wall, right? You can see the value taking on a new form as the worker labors. It's the worker who's the mover who actually transforms it into a new commodity. The machine ultimately costs a certain amount of socially necessary labor power to be produced in the first place. And over time, again, the worker works the machine. The machine needs the worker to actually be useful. And what happens is over time, bit by bit by bit, the value of that machinery is transferred onto every little commodity that goes through the process. It wears away. Is not creating new value, ultimately. It is just a qualitative transformation of the original form of its value. So the only real part of this productive process that is generating new value is the worker, is the labor power. And in this way, actually, we can see how the social relations are recreated, how the boss is recreated as a boss, how the worker is recreated as a worker. Because that surplus value that is generated by the workers, that profit, you know, is accumulated by the capitalists. That can then be used to obviously buy more and expand production more and make more profit, ultimately like accumulate. And the capitalists have to accumulate, actually. Otherwise, if they stop that process, they get outcompeted, kicked out of the market, and lose their role as a capitalist in society. On the other side of this like concentration of wealth that's happening, is the working class. Through this process, ultimately left with absolutely no property but the ability to sell their labor power. And this is how you see a recreation of the social roles in society. So the aim, obviously, of capitalism, of capitalist production, is profit. And so in that way, the boss tries to squeeze out as much surplus as they possibly can. And there's really two ways primarily that they can do this. On the one hand, they can squeeze out more in terms of the absolute amount of surplus value. So if you don't make any other changes to the productive process, you don't change the wages, you don't change the machinery, the technique, none of that. How do you change the surplus value? Essentially by extending the working day. And this is a pretty brutal process. The capitalist in the early days, he was talking about like the 1830s and whatnot, like almost killed the working class, making them work like 12-hour days. You know, actually the state had to intervene to be like, you're literally going to destroy the productive force that you need. You know, going to destroy this necessary part of production. But you see it today in all sorts of ways. Actually, like before I went full-time, I worked remote work during like a year or so during the pandemic. And this is the thing. Most remote workers saw they weren't getting paid more. In fact, funny enough, they were getting paid less in many ways, which raised an interesting question, because what we were told was, you know, you're doing the same work, essentially. So if you're getting paid for the work that you do, which is the common sense argument, why would your wage go down if you're a remote worker? And the idea was, well, you don't have to transport it. You don't have to take like the bus. You don't have to commute anymore. You know, you don't take up space in an office anymore. And it's like, wait, is the wage covering the labor I'm doing, or is it covering my ability to work? But actually, like being at home, working remotely, was very, very useful way to extend the working day, to leak it into the personal time, because no longer was there this clear distinction of I go to the office and I work, the clock hits 5, you go home. No, now it's just like a fluid movement. You just continue working into the day. But this has happened in many, many different ways. Shift work, you know, you can have your morning shift, you know, you extend the working day, get your evening shift workers come in, necessary overtime. Actually, like I was rereading an interview with Chris Smalls from Amazon, and he was describing how on average they would have 10-hour working days, and they would have 30 minutes for a lunch break technically, and 30 minutes above that to like go to the bathroom, take a personal break, just like throughout the day. But this Amazon facility is like a freaking city. It's massive, and like, obviously, so many workers are working in this facility together. So actually, by cramming them all into this massive, massive facility means that 30-minute lunch hour is actually like not really 30 minutes at all. Just to get from the from where they're working to the cafeteria, then sit in the line to heat up their food, you know, chips away at the time that they really have outside of work. The bathroom breaks. Most of them, I think we've heard the horror stories, right? People don't get a chance to use the bathroom because the bathroom is like on the other side of this massive facility. You know, technically you have 30 minutes. Can you make it there in the 30 minutes? Because once you don't, if you go beyond it, they actually start taking it out of your wages, that you went beyond your break. But these are all sort of methods that are used to extend the working day. I should be done in like 10 minutes. The other side of this, of the bosses increasing, extracting as much surplus as possible, is the rate of exploitation. So let's say you don't really extend the working day. You still have the same day, the same hours of work. How do you produce more surplus? Essentially, this is a process that Marx called the intensification of labor. Through technique, technology, particularly machinery and automation, play a massive role in boosting the productivity of the worker. Because once you add in this element, you know, you can, in the same day, you know, the same amount of labor time has been done, let's say, but it's divided up into more commodities than ever before. Maybe, yeah, like the scone example I used, you know, like in the early days, maybe you could only make like 15 scones without any sort of machinery available, but you know, through cooperation, through a division of labor, you produce 15 scones. But then you add the element of machinery, you automate this process, you know, it improves technique. You can produce in the same hour or whatever, like 50 scones. The labor time ultimately produced, the labor time, socially necessary labor time used, actually like maybe is the same, you know, but the amount of goods that have been produced are way more. And now each of these goods is actually of less value. And that is useful. Now you can sell all of this and more people are gonna buy it because each scone is not like $2, maybe it's $1, maybe it's 50 cents because of this productivity. And the other side actually of how this is beneficial to the capitalist is that that boost of productivity also makes the necessities of life of the worker cheaper. And so actually the cost of the worker, the exchange value of the worker, which ultimately reflects their maintenance, that's what wages reflect, also gets reduced, you know, because what it takes to keep that worker alive and reproduced as the worker based on the goods in society also have become cheapened. And so the worker becomes cheapened in that way, indirectly. Now, this though, you know, I've kind of described this process and, you know, do we have to explain to the workers like, oh, you're being exploited. Let me explain to you like surplus value. I don't think so. You know, workers know they're being exploited. They may not know all the terms and the mechanisms clearly, but they know they're being exploited. And you can see that in the struggles that have occurred over the history of the working class. Actually, a whole big section of capital is devoted to the fight for the 10-hour working day. You know, to reduce that working day, within that working day, to make the ability of the workers to survive, you know, the portion of the day that goes to them to extend that, actually, to cut into the profit, the over-exploitation. And so that really, I think, shows like that the question of the length of the working day is a class struggle, not just some economic calculation or something. On the other side, I guess the effects on the working class with automation, I mean, we're living through it now, right? Like, I think this is a demand that's coming up with the port workers out in BC right now. We see it with the Writers Guild that's on strike still, I think. Because like what happens with the introduction of machinery and technology, it should be very, very beneficial, right? Because now you have, frankly, you can produce way more in the same day. So people could be able to reduce how much time they have to work. And they now have more goods available to them than ever before. It would be useful. But of course, actually with the introduction of machinery, the exact opposite happens under capitalism. It doesn't reduce exploitation, it extends it. I think I briefly mentioned this, but with the introduction of machinery, you have an incentive in particular for keeping the machine running at all hours of the day, right? To elongate the day in that sense. You have whole layoffs, you know, a reserve army of labor that Marx talked about, the unemployed, created as a permanent feature of capitalism now, right? Because you don't need as many workers when you have the introduction of machines. And what happens to these workers? They permanently just exist. Put a downward pressure onto everybody's wages because it's a threat, essentially. If you don't want to do this shitty job, this menial task, well, there's hundreds of workers lined up right behind you that desperately need work And would take your position, essentially. So, yeah, and I think, I guess I spoke a little bit how this though, is living class forces, a struggle of living class interests, not just pure graphs, economics, that the bourgeois kind of express it as. But I think one of the more important aspects of the labor theory of value is that it also gives us a scientific analysis on the roots of exploitation, but it also explains really the fundamental basis of crisis in society, the crisis of overproduction. Because on the one hand, what the labor theory of value shows is that the working class is not given back the wealth that they generate. And so with that, they're exploited, right? They're underpaid in that sense. And then so what happens to all these goods in society? We're meant to be the market. We cannot buy back these goods. And so capitalism, the system that is built on commodity production, pushing out all of these goods that then can't be realized as profits, right? It creates a crisis that the capitalists have tried to solve in various destructive ways, conquering new markets through war, destruction of the productive forces, living off of, credit, debt, spending. And in the long run, we're living through it. All of these various solutions that the bosses have tried to use have only led to a deeper crisis on a wider scale than we've ever seen before. And that is because they cannot overcome the fundamental antagonism between the workers and the bosses, based upon the unpaid labor of the working class. Okay, I'm gonna conclude pretty quickly. I should just be a couple minutes. I think one thing that really stood out to me reading about Marxist economics, really the comparison to the bourgeois who see the economy very superficially, subjectively, that explains, they see things on a one-sided way. Actually, a lot even of the left falls into this. They look at the ills of society and they only see the distribution side. They only see the wealth side. They're, under consumption, this type of overpopulation, this type of garbage theories come from seeing only one side of capitalism rather than seeing it as a whole system, production and distribution together. Marx is who really was able to dive deeper and explain and use this theory not just as an analysis, but as a weapon, a very sharp weapon in the class struggle. I think the bourgeois actually see the danger of this theory. I was reading The Economist, because they will sometimes, pay some lip service to Marx, be like, he's right here and there. Some aspects of his theory are right, whatever. But they don't want to draw the conclusion, right? They don't want to draw that there is an underlying contradiction that cannot be overcome within the system. It has to be overthrown. And they do recognize that danger. So the Economist article I read, I can't remember the exact quote or whatever, was this is being used as propaganda. We should stay away from that, And it's that shows the danger and the utility for us of the labor theory of value. Because so long as we don't understand this mechanism clearly, it will continue applying to the working class blindly, happening to us, rather than being a process that we're a part of, right? I'm going to have to skip over a little bit. Maybe in the conclusion I can talk about how we got to this point of these social relations, essentially this primitive accumulation stage of capitalism. But what Marx really showed in analyzing that history was that these relations have not always existed. There's no natural basis for the relationship of the boss and the workers. It's not existed in every single historical period of humanity's history. Actually, the point is that it's only under certain conditions that a slave becomes a slave. It's only under certain conditions that the worker becomes a worker. And actually, to change that, we are going beyond economics. We're getting into politics. We're getting into the living class struggle. And I think that what the labor theory of value does is pull the veil off of the mystery of the economy, right? Pushes away the mist that the capitalists tried to create to expose the real nature of exploitation, and in that way to sharpen the class struggle to help the workers win. I'll end there.
Thank you for listening to Fight Back Radio. Fight Back is a revolutionary organization fighting for the socialist transformation of society. We are the Canadian section of the International Marxist Tendency. we actively seek to educate workers and youth in the genuine ideas of Marxism in order to fight back against capitalist attacks and austerity and bring an end to capitalism. However, we won't be able to do this on our own. So if you agree with us, get involved. We can be found online at marxist.ca, on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok at Canada Marxists, on Instagram at Socialist Fightback, and on YouTube as Fightback La Riposte. For international news and analysis, check out In Defense of Marxism at marxist.com. The music in this episode was General Strike by Soul Jazz Orchestra. They can be found at souljazzorchestra.com.